reassembling. This is our final session. And the first speaker, well, Joseph is going to be the MC.
I will just do the last moment. And I know how to pronounce the name, Zhuzhanda dance. So we talk about pentagon, hexagon equation following full show.
Well, I'd like to thank the organizers for giving me a chance to talk. And this talk will also be on the web, on Drawer's webpage. And the handout will be on my webpage, and there will be a link from the Drawer's webpage to the handout, so you can find it. I'd like to start by trying to explain the words in the title of my talk. Oh, by the way, I hope you all have a copy of the handout.
Here.
Oh, thank you.
And thank you. When you look at it, don't be scared. I won't say half of what's there. So if you're going to be that long. So I'd like to explain about what the pentagon and hexagon equations are for a little bit. First, let me just show you slides of them, especially for those of you who know what they are, just to remind you. And then I will go into the details later. So the pentagon equation, it comes from a simple combinatorial fact. If you have four elements in a non-associative algebra, there's five ways you can multiply them, and there's reassociations going between those five ways, and those form a pentagon. And this has a topological interpretation and an algebraic interpretation, which I will talk about in a minute. The hexagon equation, it also comes from a topological fact about parenthesized braids. And it also has algebraic incarnations, and those are the ones that we will deal with. But before I go into the actual definitions of the spaces in which these equations live in, I'd like to say a word about why we care about them. So those three equations together are the defining equations for so-called associators, which were defined by Drinkfeld. And associators are the main ingredient in the construction of a universal finite type invariant for braids. And then that can be extended to knots, links, knotted trivalent graphs, tangles, all sorts of knotted structures. So associators are an important gadget and a complicated gadget. And this talk is about a beautiful result. I only wish it was mine. It was done by Furuso, and he showed that the two hexagon equations actually follow from the pentagon. So if you want to, say, construct a universal finite type invariant, what you would want to do is find the solution to this three equations. Now, these are all equations in complicated spaces, and they are complicated themselves, so this is a hard task. And with the help of Furuso's result, all you'd have to do is solve one of them, not three of them. So this is very significant. And Drawer and I wanted to understand the proof of this, and in the process, we ended up simplifying it quite a bit. So now I feel entitled to talk about it, even though it's not me who came up with it, unfortunately. So let me actually define the spaces in which we will work with. We'll denote by An the space of core diagrams of pure M braids. Algebraically, if you haven't heard about these before, then it's very easy to define. They are generated by generators denoted by Tij, where I and J are running from 1 to n, and Tii, and then we factor out by a bunch of relations. Tii is set to be 0, Tij is the same as Tji, And then we have two more interesting relations. One is that if I, J, K, and L are all distinct, then D, I, J commutes with T, K, L. This is called locality in space, and it's called locality in space because it comes from braid topology. If you have two completely isolated crossings, you can switch them. And the other one is the four-term relation, which says that if I, J, and K are distinct, then T, I, J plus T, I, K commutes with T, J, K. And this also comes from topology. Now, an easier way to think about these spaces is in terms of pictures, so-called horizontal chord diagrams. We think about the T, I, J's as a chord between strand I and strand J, and we multiply these chord diagrams by just stacking them on top of each other. And then these relations now don't even have to be thought about because the chords are symmetric and there's no chord, no horizontal chord going from one strand to itself. So we don't even need to think about those. And the locality in space can be described by a picture as here, and the four-term relation can be described by a picture as here, where the symbol means a chord from I to J plus a chord from I to K. So that's the most important space. And then a few other notations. I will denote by F2 the free Lie algebra on two elements over field K, and by UF2, the universal enveloping algebra of this, which is just non-commutative power series in two variables. If I put a little k on top in the superscript, that means that we are thinking modulo degree k plus 1. So it's just non-commutative polynomials of degree at most k. And that's all we need. A small note is that UF2, so the non-commutative power series in two elements, is almost the same space as A3. So A3 is generated by T12, T13, and T23. So it's generated by three things. But the sum of those three things is central, and UF2 is exactly the same as A3, just factored out by the center. And for our purposes, it will turn out that the center doesn't matter. So if one space is the same as the other, factored out by the center, then it's essentially, we can think of them as the same space. Now let me define what an associator is. That's the main topic of the talk. So an associator is just a group-like element of UF2. Group-like, it means that the co-product of it equals it tensor itself. But you can, if you're not familiar with that, you can just think about it as behaving like a group element. So, for example, it's invertible. So, group-like element of UF2, or you can think of it as living in A3. It doesn't really matter. Satisfying the pentagon and the hexagon equations. Let me, for 1 minute, go back to the slide on the pentagon and the hexagon. So I will not talk about how you derive the algebraic interpretations of these because I don't have the time for it, but I just like to say that of all the different notations, this is the one that we will use. So let's just for 1 second stare at this and sort of understand where things live. These T12, T23, and T24 live in A4, and phi is in UF2, so phi is a non-commutative pi-R series in two variables. So you plug in these elements from A4, apply phi formally, and then multiply them in A4, multiply the results in A4, you get an equation in A4. And similarly, the hexagon, that is an equation, that those are two equations in A3, you also have phi, plugging in various things, you can invert because phi is group-like, and you also have some exponentials. The exponentials correspond to the crossings in the topological picture. And that's just the formal pi-R series for the exponential. What I would like to do is to give you a very rough sketch of the proof as it is after simplification, and then say one word about what was simplified compared to the original. But first, let me show you the main ingredient that goes into it. This is, I call it the principle, it's really a theorem. It was proved by Grimfold and later Dror. And it says that the restriction map from associators up to degree n plus 1 to associators up to degree m is surjective. Associators degree n plus 1 means that it's a group-like element modulo degree n plus 2 that satisfies the pentagon and hexagon equations up to degree n plus 1, so modulo degree n plus 2. So we don't require it to be an honest associator, just up to some degree. After that degree, there might be some error. Another way to say it is that if you have an associator up to degree m, so a non-commutative polynomial of degree m that satisfies pentagon and hexagons up to degree m, then you can extend it to an associator up to degree m plus 1. Which would then be an associated module with degree n plus 2. A quick application of this is the proof of this is like a baby version of the proof of Fourucheau's theorem, so I will just show it very quickly. This was also proved by Grimfold and later Dror in the same paper as that one. Is that there exists a rational associator. Rational associator just means an associator with rational coefficients. So how would we prove this? This principle suggests that we have to use induction, right? You can go from a degree to the next degree, so induction is the most natural thing to do. So suppose that we have a rational associator up to degree k. So modulo degree k plus 1. We need a base case to be able to do induction, but that's easy because the element 1 in UF2 0, meaning the constant polynomial 1, does satisfy the pentagon and the hexagons up to degree 0. So that's the base case. And then for the induction step, we want to extend this, suppose that we have this phi k, which is an associator up to degree k, we want to extend it one degree up. So we want to add a homogeneous degree k plus 1 part to it. And the result we will call phi k plus 1. Now, what do we want? We want phi k plus 1 to satisfy the pentagon and the hexagons. So let's plug it into the pentagon and the hexagons, plug it as phi k plus little phi k plus 1, then expand and write out the degree k plus 1 part of the equations, and up to K is automatically satisfied because 5K satisfies them. So what you get in degree K plus 1 is linear equations. Linear equations for little phi k plus 1 with rational coefficients, because the pentagon and the hexagon equations both have rational coefficients. Now, by the principle, we know that phi k can be extended somehow. It doesn't say that it can be extended rationally, but we know that there's at least one extension, because anything can be extended 1 degree up. And so we know that these linear equations have some solution. And it's basically neural algebra that if it's linear equations with rational coefficients and they have some solution, then they have a rational solution. So we know that there is a rational solution, so we can extend 1 degree up, and so we can extend as long as we want. So rational associators exist. Now, finally, we arrive to the statement of the theorem. So let me just quickly go through it again. I basically said what it is before. It says that if you have a group-like element of UF2, there's this small constraint that the second coefficient, meaning the coefficient of xy, in it has to be 1 over 24. This is basically what remains of all the hexagon equations, this small thing. If it's not satisfied, then phi satisfies some rescaled hexagons, but I will not go into that. Now, also assume that phi satisfies the pentagon equations, which is same as I showed before. Then the conclusion is that phi also satisfies the hexagons in A3, so the hexagons basically follow from the pentagon, except for that one small thing in degree 2. And therefore phi is an associator. So let me show you a quick sketch of some of the proof. Like before, we'll do it by induction. Suppose that phi satisfies the pentagon, and so pentagon all the way, and suppose that it satisfies the hexagon up to modulo degree k, so up to degree k minus 1. And what we want to do is to prove that it satisfies the hexagon up to degree k, so modulo degree k plus 1. So we have pentagon all the way, hexagon somewhere up to some point, and we want to go up one step with the hexagon. The base case I will just skip over for now, because I don't want to keep you here too long. So it's basically in degree 0, 1, and 2, you have to do an easy direct computation check that everything breaks. Turns out that everything breaks. So we can assume that k is at least 3. And then for the induction step, again, we use the principle. So we know that there exists an associator phi prime such that phi equals to phi prime modulo degree k. So you just take phi up to degree k plus 1, like truncate it, and then extend that thing to an associator by the principle, and that's phi prime. So what is phi minus phi prime? It will be some little phi k, which is homogeneous of degree k, plus some higher order terms. Now, little phi k equals phi minus phi prime modulo degree k plus 1, and we can show that this implies that it's primitive. So this part here will seem a little bit random, but this is exactly the condition that we need for a lemma that happens to be true and gives you the proof, which is basically a linearized version of the theorem. So for that, you need the little phyke to be, as opposed to group-like, it has to be primitive. So it's like the group version and the Lie algebra version. So, and it happens, that happens to be true. Now also, because phi and phi prime satisfies the pentagon, if you plug this into the pentagon and take the degree k part, it turns out that phi k satisfies a linearized version of the pentagon. And also we know that k is at least 3 because we've checked the base cases. And there's a hard part, what we call the hard part of the proof, or the main lemma proof by Furuso, which says that from these conditions you can deduce that this little phi k satisfies the linearized versions, some linearized versions of the hexagons. And the same way that we got from the pentagon to the linearized pentagon, so these satisfy the pentagon, and we deduce that little phi satisfies the linearized pentagon, we can go then back the other way. So the fact that little phi satisfies the linearized hexagons and phi prime satisfies the hexagons, we can deduce that phi satisfies the real hexagons up to degree k plus 1, and that's the induction step. And then you're done. So this this main lemma, or hard part, is just the linear version of the whole theorem, and the proof of it is on the other side of your handout, and I will not talk about it at all, but hopefully it's written semi-understandably, so if you want to look at it, you might be able to understand it. So I think I'll leave it at that, that this is a linear version, and the proof is half a page, really densely written. So what was simplified? The most significant simplification probably is that in Furuso's paper there's a major algebraic geometry part using the groups GT and GRT, if you know what they are. And that was replaced by the proof that I just told you. So using this principle of being able to do this induction and this extension from one degree to the next. Also, for the proof of this, for the proof of this linearized version, maybe I'll just, without saying anything, just sort of flash it. So, for this part, that lemma was phrased a little bit differently. He puts it in terms of spherical braid chord diagrams, and the statement is actually kind of prettier that way because it makes it extremely symmetric. But then you have to go back and forth between the spherical braids and the non-spherical braids, which is not hard because, again, they are related by the same way that they only differ in a center. But still, you have to pass back and forth. And also, it makes the proof also more symmetric, which I found actually not helpful because it makes it harder to figure out how on earth he came up with it. Because if you do it the non-symmetric way, then the lack of symmetry kind of leads you in the combinatorics. It helps you figure out what to do next. So it's probably a matter of taste. I translated that to just normal braid horizontal chord diagram, so not the spherical braid version. And then that other side of the handout is just a fun little thing. He uses a certain projection which seems kind of out of the blue to prove the one of the linearized hexagons from the pentagon, which actually has a kind of a cool topological interpretation, which I would talk about if I had another half hour, but I don't. So thank you for listening and staying so late. It was a pleasure to be here.
Questions or remarks?
Do you see a way to apply this beautiful fact that you're proving to invariants or something?
If we could construct an associator, that would be extremely helpful. But
You're saying it might help in
constructing an associator, because if you want to compute an associator, it would be easier to work with just the pentagon equation recursively than to let
right,
them off the option.
It relieves you of having to check hexagon.
Yeah. But I personally haven't tried to do that.
More questions?
I think from my perspective, it was just so unbelievable that the pentagon implies the hexagons that we had to verify it.
Right.
And then you read his paper, and it's actually a bit unbelievable because it's very sort of hard.
Yeah.
And so it was worth simplifying,
sure.
That's all. But it, of course, was correct, you know.
Comments?